Okay, is everybody happy, joyous, and free?
Yes, sir.
Good. My name is Owen Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hi, my name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the NABA Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Well, tonight I have the privilege to introduce our speaker. I've known him for many, many, many years, and he is a miraculous man in many ways. And me personally, he's shown me that there is a great, fun way of life after this despair. So I think that we'll all enjoy the speaker tonight as I give you Thomas from the Dalton Group.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Thomas Charles Moran, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, y'all. You can call me Tommy. It's always an honor when you're asked to tell your story. I have to tell y'all, it's my least favorite thing to do. And as I was walking up here, I thought, you know, I should have maybe gone to the bathroom. But I did it, and that'll be okay. I'm dead serious about my recovery and about sobriety, but I do not wear it like a tight cloak. I think a sense of humor serves us well. And God knows I'd just be crying all the time if I couldn't laugh. So if I say something that offends you, good. And if I say something that you disagree with, call your sponsor. And if I say something that you like, well, I appreciate it. My sobriety date is August 22nd, 1997, and I don't say that out of pride. I say it out of genuine humility and amazement. I am living proof that anybody can get and stay sober. If you think you can't, I'm proof that you can. I'm a product of the court system. I was court ordered not once, not twice, but three times by the same judge, Judge Moran. We have the same last name, and I use that to my advantage, I assure you, until she started acting like I was giving her family a bad name, and then we sort of split ways. But I am grateful that I haven't had to pick up a drink or a mind-altering substance so far today, because I used to live a life that I didn't know how to live without something. Just a little something to get me up. Just a little something to get me by. Just a little something to take that edge off. Just a little something to make it okay for me to be with y'all. Because my core issue is and always will be is fear. I'm fearful of you. I'm fearful of what you want. And I'm fearful of what you might do to me. And I'm even more afraid that you might find me out. That you might see behind this facade that I so gleefully put up so I can be with y'all. The Japanese people, they're amazing for a lot of reasons, but they have this theory that people have three faces. There's the face that you show to the public, there's the face that you show to your family, and then there's the face that you never show to anybody. I think all three of mine I didn't want to show to anybody. Because I was afraid that you would find me not enough. That was my deal. No matter what I did, I wasn't going to be enough. No matter how much I accomplished, it wasn't going to make it okay. It just wasn't okay. And some of y'all have heard Earl Hightower, and I've heard him speak a lot. And I love it when he says, you know, in the first grade, I'm pretty sure I could have used a drink. And I get that because, man, I never, ever felt comfortable in my own skin. It just was a little too tight or a little too loose. but I could just never be okay being with me. So I learned at an early age how to medicate that. And I qualify for probably every 12-step program on earth, but I believe in the singleness of purpose. I love seeing that sign, and I will honor that. But I have you know, I never met any substance that I did not like and abuse. And I was an equal opportunity user. We used to have this thing. I owned a Sandbar and Grill down there on Piedmont for 20 years. And we had this thing called Sober October. And what would happen is the bartenders and bar owners around the area would put $100 in the pot, and whoever could stay sober the longest got all the money. So in about 5 days, I'd just go, I'm out. Because I proved to myself I could go to 5 days, and if you cannot drink for 5 days, surely you don't have a problem. Alcoholics was that guy that I saw going up and down Piedmont with all his possessions in a shopping cart begging for cigarettes. That's what an alcoholic was. But I know now today an alcoholic can be anybody. It's an equal opportunity disease. It knows no social strata. It cares not. It is truly like that rapacious creditor that they talk about in the book. And all it wants, it's us dead. Doesn't care how it happens. And it does not mourn someone as soon as it gets them and it kills them. You know what it does? It looks around the room and goes, who's next? I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy. I drank till I had seizures. I actually said, I will do this till I die. Well, I did twice. A normal person might go, hey, maybe I shouldn't be doing that. That wasn't my reaction. So they tell you to say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It was great, then it wasn't, and this is better. So thanks for letting me share. I wish it was that easy. To go along with my alcoholism, I have a little thing called ADD, and I'm pretty sure I've always had that. And I also have neuromuscular disease that you can't see, but it left me a little reminder. I have ptosis in this eye, and it's from myasthenia gravis. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's weaknesses of the muscle and da-da-da, blah-blah-blah. And I share that because it's going to be a big part of my story when I get all leathered up here in a minute. Alcohol did not take a single thing from me, not one. I willingly gave it to it. I gave it everything I had because it was the only friend I thought I had. It worked, and it worked for a long time, and then it didn't work at all, and it's never worked again. But it didn't stop me from trying. I grew up in an alcoholic family over here in Brookhaven by Silver Lake. That kind of family looked very nice from the street, you know, nice cars, nice house, all the kids dressed, had their teeth. But you close that door and it was madness and mayhem because both my parents were alcoholics, and I was, they say, a gift from God. I say that was a mistake because I was 7 years younger than my sisters, and my parents just sort of checked out after they parented them. They were done. I was a boy. They just sort of like threw me out of the house and see you later. And I like that. I like being a child of the streets back in the 60s. It was awesome. You got in trouble, the cops would just bring you home. What's none of this take you to jail stuff? Well, they took us once. But there used to be a liquor store behind Lenox Square, and we got caught getting liquor there at 16. That's the first time I got thrown in jail. First time I got drunk and passed out, blacked out, I was 14. My parents were having a cocktail party. And, you know, how do you know you're a blackout drinker? How do you know that? If you blacked out, how do you know? That was always the question. I don't know. And then I realized I didn't remember any of the 80s. So I guess I was just blacked out. But when I was 14, I come to naked on the bathroom floor with my mom and dad standing over me and all their friends in this bathroom. And do y'all remember being 14 and how shy you could be then? Think about it. And you're naked? Oh my God, it was horrible. I'm surprised I didn't become a serial killer. But that was my first experience with throwing up, blacking out. And I talked to this guy yesterday, and he had a similar experience. He had to go to the hospital, though. He had an alcohol poisoning. And he goes, and I never drank again. And I looked at him, and I went, you're stupid. I didn't say that, but that's what I thought, because I couldn't wait to do it again. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, yeah. Let's drink till we're stupid and forget where we are and don't have any clothes on. And yeah, I'm in. Where'd I sign up? So this is what alcohol did for me. I was determined to make it pay because it took my family from me. It took my childhood. It took my mom and dad. I learned to cook because they wouldn't. So that was a plus. But all I wanted was somebody to tell me I couldn't do something. You know, somebody care enough to say, no, you can't do that. I never heard no, not ever. I heard you better not a lot, but not no. So, alcohol, with me being a co-conspirator, I fell off an 80-foot cliff and lived to tell about it. I dove from 30 feet up into 2 feet of water. I'm an inch shorter because of that one. I tanked my college career, borrowed a fraternity brother's car, had this blind date with this beautiful little girl from Atlanta, and in a blackout, bounced that Volkswagen off a curb 15 feet up into the air into a tree and broke her back. I walked away without a scratch. I came to, and I was on a porch saying, I think I've been in an accident. And when the police came, we're at the hospital, and I was so distraught, and he said, what happened? And this is when I became a professional liar. I said, the car ran us off the road. That wasn't true. But it served my purpose. It served my needs. And I didn't get a ticket. But I was taking a full load of classes, and instead of going to the dean and withdrawing emergency withdrawal, I just never went to school again and went to the hospital every day. And I got 6 F's, and that pretty much will tank a college career. So, you know, God works in mysterious ways. Kept a jerk from being an attorney, so that's not all bad. So, you know, we do what we do, and we get what we get, and the party's on, and I'm in the restaurant bar business. I worked all over Texas with Daddy's Money, and they sent me back here. I worked at Billy's and Buckhead, if any of y'all remember those days. God bless your livers. And then I opened up my own place, and it's an alcoholic's dream job. Seriously. That and tendon bar, either one. So, you know, I think I'm all that, and I've got a bag of chips, and, you know, I'm doing the deal, and I meet this pretty little girl, and one night I decided to invite 40 of my best friends, and I hired a bus, and we're going to go bar hopping for New Year's Eve. Now, I don't know about y'all, but me, it was the pre-party parties that were really kicking my tail. You know, and listen, I'll tell you how party season was in my life. Let's see if I can remember it right. Labor Day, September, had Labor Day, and then that sort of rolled into Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, Valentine's, my birthday. What's the one after? St. Patrick's Day. Everybody's Irish. Kiss me. And then there's another national holiday, Easter, Memorial Day, 4th of July, now it's September again. So, I mean, it's just like, you know, come up for air, get drunk, get whatever, go back under submarine. And I had been up for maybe 6 weeks before that New Year's Eve party, and it was hot in this house. and it was cold outside, and I was greeting people, letting them in, greeting people, letting them in, hot and cold, and hot and cold. Next thing I know, I come to, and they are beating the crap out of my chest, trying to get my heart started. And I threw my first seizure. And as I came to, there happened to, when you dial 911, like y'all probably know this, a policeman shows up. Not just an ambulance, but a policeman. And that was the first person that talked to me. He goes, Mr. Moran, have you been doing any drugs? And I don't know why I said this, because I'm such a smart ass. I said, yeah, heroin. And I passed right out. Now, I had never, ever done that drug. Ever. I mean, I took care of that later, but I had, up to that point, I had not done that. And so I came to, and they said, we're going to put you in an ambulance. Da, da, da. And I said, no. I did know this. If you refuse to go, they can't make you go to the hospital, because I'm so smart. And I said, no, that's all right. I got a party to go to. Well, what I didn't know was it was like rats jumping off a sinking ship when the cops showed up. People going out windows and screens kicked out. And just mayhem. But five people stayed. So me and five idiots get on this bus. And that little pretty girl was one of them. And man, I don't know if you've ever had a grandma seizure. First off, I tried to butt my tongue off, so it was swollen and hurt. And every muscle in my body hurt. I don't mean just kind of hurt. I mean hurt. And that pretty little girl goes, don't you ever get tired of this? I went, mm-mm. I want to do it till it kills me. And she goes, it just did. And I went, no, it didn't. But it did. So that was the first one. I had another one. Let me tell you the best place to have a grandma seizure is in court. Because if you have one in court, you get to go first. Because they don't want you dying in their courtroom. So I got a little overamp celebrating going to court and sitting next to my wife. And she goes, it was, you started kicking the bench in front of you, it sounded like, and it's just dead silent. It sounded like the loudest sound she had ever heard. And she goes, and then you fell out. Well, I came to, and I hear this voice go, Mr. Moran, are you all right? And I said, without thinking, no, but I use a word before that, F no. And then I realized it was the judge. Oh, Lord. And she goes, I'm going to continue your case, da 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 da. And I knew I would get some sympathy if I went through with it. So I said, no, ma'am, if it's all right with you, I'm here, you're here, let's just get this over with. And so I'm up there, and I'm doing my little song and dance, because I'd talked my way out of it twice before, and I had no doubts I was going to do that again. And next thing I know, I'm in handcuffs, and the prosecutor is saying all these mean things about me, and talking 3 to 5, and just language I didn't like. And then she said, Your Honor, it's apparent to me Mr. Moran is on some kind of substance. Da, da, da. And I said, how dare you? Excuse me if anybody in here has it. I apologize. I have epilepsy. I forgot to take my medication today. Now, I don't have epilepsy, nor have I ever had it. But I thought I did the first time I had that seizure, because I went to the doctor and told him that. And he did all these tests, and then he pushed his dictionary across the desk at me. He goes, Mr. Moran, I want you to look up the word moderation. Because it's apparent to me you don't have it in your dictionary. Which is funny, and it's true, but what he did realize is he had a full-blown alcoholic addict in front of him, that moderation is not ever going to be part of my vocabulary, ever. So that prosecutor saying those mean things, and I pulled that ace out of the hole, and I walked again, and I'm thinking, just as I'm turning to go, I'm thinking, these are the stupidest people I've ever dealt with. And then she did it. She goes, because Mr. Moran's numerous, and this is over a 5-year period, y'all, we want him to take a drug screen every week. And I went, oh, man. And then I went, man, all those people at the bar are always talking about beating drug screens. I'll just ask them what to do, and everything will be great. You know, the party's on. And so I asked them. They told me. I went and had my first drug screening. I came back positive for stuff I hadn't even done. And I'm going, God almighty, this is a nightmare. And I'm driving down the road going up to Roswell Road, going up past 8111 to the courthouse, and I've got that piece of paper in my hand, and I throw it out the window. And I get there and doing my little song and dance and showing them my court papers that I'd been signing left-handed, or just anybody I knew, he would sign this for me. And that prosecutor, same one, she insisted on seeing my drug screen. And I went, that started this week? I thought it started today. And guess what they did? They let me go. And that's when I realized they didn't really want me to be in trouble. What they wanted me was to stop being crazy. They wanted me to stop acting the fool. They wanted me to be just a citizen. So I start going to meetings online. It was awesome. You could go in your underwear. You could smoke during them. You could even drink during them if you wanted to. But I couldn't, because all those people told me how to beat those screens. Lied. And so I sobered up. Kind of. My fog is still pretty thick. Now, I'm calling the AA hotline trying to convince this guy I'm not an alcoholic. Like he cared. But we had numerous conversations, and just fast forward real quick. I was sitting in 8111 one day. I hear him speak. He's in the meeting I'm in. And I went up to him afterwards. He goes, I know who you are. I went, oh, dude, I'm so sorry. So he's gone on to a big meeting in the sky, but he was such a great guy, especially about that, too, because I was just out of control. But I befriend these two people, well, a lot of people, actually, online, and they were saying F to F and sponsor and big book, all this stuff I didn't understand, and I would just act like I didn't read it, because you're not talking, you're reading it. So I'd wait till somebody else was stupid enough to go, what's that? And so, you know, I get a lot of my answers met like that, because I still had to prop up that false facade. Y'all know the one I'm talking about? The one that makes it okay to be me? And anyway, this guy comes to town. His bottom was a crack pipe and a pair of shorts, and she was a hooker, and they had nothing but a shopping cart. But now he's this big plumbing magnet guy in Dallas-Fort Worth. I mean, awesome guy, huge. I mean, he's like 6'8 and 300 pounds, just huge, like a linebacker. He comes to my house and he talks to me for about 5 minutes. He goes, you know, T, I've met a lot of people in my time in AA. Well, I bet you have. He goes, I've never met anybody more full of it than you. He goes, go get that car. Well, I forgot to tell y'all, before they got there, I would go to 8111 because I knew where it was. And I'd stand outside, and I was the unofficial greeter. People would go into the meetings. I'd say, hey, good to see you. I'm glad you're here. Enjoy the meeting. And then they would leave. They'd come out. Hey, I was the man. I'm glad you're here. Good to see you. Because I wanted these people that were coming to think I actually went to meetings there. Now, I could have gone inside, you know, but I'm crazy. So, but I just want people to know my face so they'll act like I go inside, because I'm a liar. Yeah, I grew up in a family that never thought the story was good enough until you embellished it. So that's really hard for me still. So if I have lied to you so far, I do not know it. I don't think I have, but you know, you never know. So anyway, he drives me back to 8111, and he puts me right in my spot, my greeter spot. He goes, stand right here and don't move. And I'm thinking, boy, I know how to do that. I've done that for 2 weeks. And he comes back and he's got this little short brown man with him. And he goes, this is your sponsor. Do everything he says or I will come back to town and kick your behind. And I'm thinking, this guy means it. So I met Dwayne, and then we went to that other AA clubhouse, the Waffle House. And we immediately started this. No ifs, ands, or buts, just jumped right in. And I'm amazed at people that come in and say, well, I saw those steps on the wall, or I saw those traditions. I guarantee I was probably in there 6 months and never realized they were on the wall. I called them one day and I said, you know all that stuff they read before the meeting? Did you know it was in this book? I'm serious. I mean, that fog was so thick. And he would just laugh and hang up. Bless his heart. He's still my sponsor. So I'm on this road to recovery, and I'm doing the deal, and I'm on fire. You know how people get on fire for AA, 12 steps, and I still owned a bar. I didn't really have to work, so I just went to meetings all day long. I mean, just I went to them like I was an alcoholic. You know how you can't get enough? You know when you're drinking, you just can't get enough. I just need a little bit more. I was that way for recovery. I just need a little bit more. Am I out of time? Oh, you gave me that face. I was like, oh my God, I got to get sober. Oh my God. So, you know, a lot of people's story, the worst things that happened were before they got here. It's not my experience. My experience is the worst things that ever happened to me in recovery. And I used to think God got me sober so I could repair my marriage. What he did was he got me sober so I didn't kill anybody when she divorced me. So I didn't act a fool and go crazy. So I didn't kill myself when she took my kids away from me. And it hurt so bad my body would ache. And you know how a lot of people lose everything before they get here? I have to do it different. I lost everything at 3 years, 3 to 5 years sober. I couldn't do that bar anymore, so I sold it. I was teaching Sunday school. That's pretty humorous in itself. And my co-teacher said, "Hey, I'm gonna get a real estate company going, and we're hiring agents. We'll pay for you to go to school." And I went, "Thank you, God." And I went. And I got my real estate license, and the market tanked. So, you know, I didn't have anybody paying the bills. I turned right. The economy turned left. So I got to experience foreclosures, assets seizures, and repossessions before it became popular. You know, I was ahead of the curve. So, and I was okay. I said, "Fine, God, take it all. You've taken my family, you've taken my business, you've taken everything I owned. I still have my health, I still have my sobriety, and that's all I need." Then he took my health. And it started with just a little hand shimmer like that. And then some days it would be so bad, I would be giving out the chips and I would have to hold on to the table at 8111 and it would just be banging. And of course, I'm not going to go to the doctor because I'm a guy. So I let a doctor's wife diagnose me in the group. You know, because I love AA. We think we've been to Harvard Medical School sometimes. Or legal advice. It's just incredible. I love alcoholics. And so I just self-diagnosed myself with mechanic's palsy because I got some hot oil in my eye when I changed the oil in my truck. Guess what? There's no such thing. I didn't know that. It sounded good. What's wrong with you? I got mechanic's palsy. It's manly. So I go finally... I was at my old home group, Mount Vernon, sitting at the picnic table out front of the group, and this guy walks up to me and goes, "My mom owns a treatment facility. Do you know anybody that needs a job?" And I start rolling through all the guys I work with and stuff. Then I remembered I didn't have any gas in my car, and I had $2 in my pocket. I said, "No, I think I might be interested in doing that." Because my real estate career was not taking off quite like I expected. And I'm burning through everything. I mean, just burning through money left and right. And so I started working in treatment as a mental health assistant, taking them to meetings, just interacting with them, having meetings in the house. I loved it. I never thought about working in treatment, never. It's not my thing. And then when I left that job 3 years later, I was the assistant program director. And then she fired me. And that made me mad. And so I sat at my house and pouted. But I had to move because I'd lost the house. So, but I got a house up at the lake. It was nice. And so I'm sitting up there, and I'm getting unemployment, and it's not really taking care of stuff. And I'm fishing all day and just goofing off all the time. Going to meetings, the coming group. It was awesome. And I have a friend. He happens to be here. And I had referred him to a place called Mar years earlier when he was struggling. He goes, why don't you call them? Why don't you contact them? And I don't know, some of y'all know about Mar, but in the treatment business, Mar is the gold standard. They are the ones that everybody else is measured against. And I'm thinking, nah, man, they're real. I'm just sort of like not. And he kept on, and I finally went, all right, I'll go up there. And I went up there, and I met with Doug Brush, and I loved him immediately. He is the guy I want to be when I grow up. He's younger than me. That would probably be a bonus. But he is not one of us, but he is, if you know what that means. I always teased him and said, if you drank with me, Doug, I could help you push through that stopping part. That's true. So he said he didn't have a job, but would I be willing to do volunteer training? I said, sure, I'm not doing anything. So I do volunteer training, and about halfway through, he goes, okay, we're going to hire you. So I don't know what that all meant. It's all in God's hands. And so they not only hired me, they paid for me to go back to school and become certified and all that. And right about the time, halfway through, I started getting sicker and sicker. I don't mean just kind of sick. I mean like can't lift your arms up sick. Can't control your head muscles, can't chew food, can't breathe. A crisis in myasthenia gravis is the muscles stop working, and how people die, the muscles that control your lungs just stop. And you literally drown in a room full of air. What's one of my hugest fears? Drowning. How many of those crisis episodes did I have? More than I'd like to admit. And they sent me to a breath specialist, and she goes, you ran outside, didn't you? And I went, yes, I did. She goes, there's no more air out there than there is in your house. And I went, that might be true, but it was like 20 degrees colder. I was hoping that would just sort of like startle my system into working. She goes, well, two things are going to happen. Three, actually. She goes, you're going to not breathe and die, or you'll pass out and die, or you'll just start breathing. And then she gave me some techniques, and because the harder you try, the less you can. Da da da. So anyway, man, I'm mad at God now. Let me tell you, He has taken everything. I'm still not using. I'm still not drinking. Thinking about it pretty hard. And I mean, I'm just railing at Him. You know, those morning sessions on my knees are no longer pleasant. I mean, we're going toe-to-toe, and I'm just telling him what I think about what he's given me. And I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. And I have probably the roughest week I've ever had. And I just went, you know what, God, if this is it. The teacher at the school asked me not to come back. I was scaring the other students. At work, they're thinking about putting me on a leave of absence because I'm scaring the clients and the staff. And it's just not good. Y'all want to know what true humility is? Being a men's public restroom and have to ask a stranger to help you unzip or zip up your pants. Because I did not have the strength to do it. And just a quick aside, not one time did anybody ever say no, they wouldn't help me. Not once. Well, once, but that was in a parking lot, so they don't count. I'm pretty sure this bus driver, she was huge, too. And I needed somebody to help me open my car door, and I asked her if she'd help. I think she thought I was doing a Ted Bundy. I was thinking, man, you couldn't even get in this car. That resentment, I need to let go of. So I'm sick. I'm sick and tired. And I go, I'm going to take care of business. I'm just going to do what I know to do, and I'm going to end it here. And my kids don't know I'm sick because I wouldn't tell them. Hardly anybody knew I was sick. And I'm laying in my bed up at the lake, and then I just started laughing. I couldn't lift my arms. Matter of fact, I couldn't move anything. If I could have reached over to that drawer, I don't think I had the strength to open it. And if I had the strength to open it, I'm pretty sure I could not have lifted that hog lug up out of there, because it was heavy, it was big, 357. And God, if I had gotten it out, I know I couldn't have cocked it, let alone pulled the trigger. And that's when, you know, sometimes we just have those moments. I felt God's genuine presence twice, and this was the second time. The first time is when He helped me deliver my baby and my daughter in an emergency home birth. That'll sober you up, by the way. You ever drink yourself sober? Man, what a waste of money. And at that moment, I had that epiphany, and I said, I get it, God. I understand. You've been doing your job. I haven't been doing mine. Please forgive me for what I was thinking about doing. You all can call Him a higher power if you want to. I just call Him God. I said, I promise I'll start doing what I need to do. I'll do my part. You've been doing your part. And I didn't get up and walk off of my bed like Lazarus did, but I'll tell y'all one thing. Every day I got a little bit better. Every day, a little bit better. I was taking 36 pills a day. Today I take zero. I've been in remission, gosh, 8 years now. I still have it. You want to hear a joke? They don't know what causes it. And there's no cure for it. Y'all got that. It's called alcoholism. Nobody knows what causes that. There's no real cure for it. There's treatment. Y'all know? There's treatment. Did y'all know there's a chapter in here how it works? There is a solution. Oh my God. Did y'all know that? Do you know if you do it, you get better? So, well, you could be better than me, but I am a satisfied customer of 12 steps in recovery. That and my God of my misunderstanding have given me truly a life worth living and a genuine purpose. The two things I always wanted, the two things that I lacked, the things that I tried to fill up that hole with, boats, cars, money, girls, houses, stuff, never completed me. God does. I didn't know that lack of God was my dilemma. I didn't realize I wasn't God until I got here. I didn't realize how much I needed a God of my understanding until I got here. So I'm glad y'all are here, and I'm glad I got to be here with y'all. And if you don't hear anything else tonight, hear this. My favorite sentence in this book. It works. It really does. Thank y'all.
Thank you, Tommy. That was really inspiring. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight and hear your story. A lot of it sounded like me, especially the growing up part. We've asked Norm to come up and do the chips for us. They're right here.
My name's Norm. I'm an alcoholic. This is the chip system we have to celebrate our quantity of time and hopefully the quality at some point. Start with a white chip. If you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, anybody need a white chip? Anybody want a white chip? Yeah! Silver chip for 30 days and 30 nights in a row. A red chip for 90 days, 3 months. A yellow chip for 6 months, a long time. Green chip for 9 months. And a blue chip for years or more. Terry!
I'm Terry and I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date is February 20th, 1990. Thank you, Tommy, for your story. One of the gifts of being around a little while, you get to see people grow up. And I'll keep it short, man. If it didn't work, I wouldn't be here. I would not be here. So, thanks a lot.
Well, my head was in tomorrow, and my feet followed history. I had it an insane notion. I could hoodoo everything around me. No. 'Cause too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. I got a nudge from the judge, thought it put me in recovery. But the plug.